It has been too long. Welcome back to a live in-studio listener call-in variety of perspectives from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan, so delighted to be back in the environs of our home studio here on Red Barber Plaza. And if you were tuned into the program way back in 2019, when we were live and in studio and all that, you might recall the program we did with Jack Romberg. He had just announced his impending retirement as the spiritual leader of Tallahassee's Temple Israel congregation. And back then, as we chatted, he indicated he would be doing some writing, and he'd have some extra time to, you know, do those sorts of things. And it turns out he did precisely that. Jack has a book. It's called A Doorway to Heroism. It is now out. He's going to be doing a signing of the work tonight, starting at 7 at Temple Israel. And if you plan to go, there is registration that is required in order to make sure that everyone is properly socially distanced and all that. And I think what Jack, Sally Bradshaw at Midtown Reader is kind of coordinating that, if I am not mistaken here.
Correct. And it's not just the signing. I actually will be doing a talking about the research that I did. And I've also put together a PowerPoint with photos of different things that I think people will be interested in seeing.
That is terrific. Well, without getting into too many spoilers here in advance of that presentation, we do want to talk to Jack and find out the motivation for the work, some of the highlights of the book, and invite your participation as well, because you are always welcome to be part of the conversation at 850-414-1234. Number hasn't changed. You can also email us, perspectives@wfsu.org. Whatever possessed you to write this book, Jack? We talked about that. You said you were going to be probably embarking on a literary pursuit involving a Holocaust story, and you came up with the one involving your uncle. Tell us about it. What motivated that?
Well, way back when I was a kid, Uncle Richard, Richard Stern, I would say Uncle Richard, he's my great uncle, actually. He had raised my father, and he looked at me and my brothers as his grandchildren. So I had a relationship with him until I was 13 and a half years old, and that's when he passed away. That was at the end of 1967. And I always was interested in him, but as a child, I did not know much about his history. The only thing I had learned as a child when I was about 8 years old was that he had served for the U.S. Army in World War II. But I didn't know anything else about what he had done, how he had protested against the Nazis, and how he had served in the German army in World War I, or any of the details of anything that I had learned later. Well, I got very interested in his history already in college, because I majored in history in college, and German history was one of the key points that I was focusing on in college. But even then, I didn't know a lot, although I had seen that my father had Uncle Richard's documents and a pile of letters that he had either written or received, most of them not in English, but in German, and a lot of those letters handwritten, not even typed. So I knew that Dad had that, and I knew that Dad had actually newspaper articles about Uncle Richard going back to the 1940s and 1944, you know, when he had served in World War II. But again, I wasn't deep into everything. Well, when my mom was selling their house in 2017 and my dad had passed a number of years earlier, she had said to me that she had boxes of things she was going to throw out and that had all this stuff that Dad had put together. Most of them were albums with photos and whatever. And I said, Mom, don't throw anything out yet. Don't do that. Let me come down, because she lived in Boynton Beach. And I said, let me come down and take all those boxes and I'll bring them back up to Tallahassee. I'll look through them and I'll throw out anything worth throwing out and I'll keep anything worth keeping. Well, when I got them up here, one of the boxes that I opened had piles of Uncle Richard's documents and all of his letters and the newspaper articles about him that were done in New York, including a big, big article on the New York Herald Tribune, which was one of the big newspapers, you know, in New York back in the 1940s. And for example, one of the documents that I found that just blew me away was his service booklet from the German Army in World War I. Wow. It just blew me away. And I realized I had to get this translated. So, but it turned out, for example, that that booklet has a list of every battle he was in World War I. Just an example of the things that's in that booklet. So when I saw this, and I saw all the articles, and I saw piles of other documents, and plus a lot of documents from the American Army and connected to his coming to America, I realized that his book is the one I should write. And I also felt it was important because there are so many aspects of his life and what he experienced as a German Jew, first in Germany and then, of course, in America. What he had experienced was part of history lessons that are very, very relevant to right now.
He was part of a rather small fraternity, if you will, a dedicated and patriotic German fighting for the Kaiser in World War I, and then immigrating to America when he saw what was going on in his home country. How did that realization build in his life for him to make that decision and that immigration?
Well, so let me start how he got into World War I. His older brother, Heinrich Stern, he was a volunteer to the German Army on August 4th of 1914. August 4th of 1914 was when Kaiser Wilhelm, the king, the emperor of Germany, had announced that everybody in Germany should be treated equally. It did not matter what your religion was. It did not matter what your politics was, and it did not matter what your ethnicity was. Everybody should be treated equally. And so a number of Jews decided that they have to volunteer and show their patriotism to Germany. And so his older brother, Heinrich Stern, volunteered on August 4th, the day that came out from Kaiser Wilhelm. Well, by the middle of 1916, there was a lot of feeling in Germany that they were losing. So it was in 1917 that Uncle Richard was drafted into the Army. And what was amazing is that he felt that even though they may be losing the war, he had to do the patriotic thing for the German Army. And he ended up getting a medal, getting decorated as a brave person in the German Army. Well, he then, after the war, his family, like about 85% of the Jews in Germany, his family and he was very supportive of the new government, which was the Weimar Republic, a democratic Republican government that was put together in Germany right after the war. And he became very active in the Social Democratic Party. So he then was active in that. But then when the Nazis took power in 1933, he felt that this would be temporary because they couldn't always win elections. And he then stood up to protest against them and their first action against the Jewish people, which was on April 1st of 1933. That was the boycott of Jewish businesses. And it turned out, when I did the research in Cologne, Germany in 2019, and I was working with different historians and so forth there, I learned from them that they had found that he was the only Jewish person to stand up and protest. The other reason he protested, and he had told this to his family, was that being part of the Social Democratic Party and being a supporter of the Democratic Republic, he was standing up for people's civil rights. So that was what happened that was what he was doing then. And what happened to him is he was arrested. But a person who knew him from serving with him in the army was a policeman at the station that he was taken to when he was arrested, and that person sneaked him out the back door of the police station. So the rest of the 1930s got worse and worse, not just for Uncle Richard, but for the Jewish people in Germany in general. And every year was an increase of oppression of the Jewish people in different ways, and they were then kept from being part of certain things and kicked out of certain businesses and kicked out of certain positions. For example, they could not be attorneys anymore. They could not be part of the civil government anymore. They could not be doctors, you know, used by anybody other than other Jews anymore. You know, all this happened. And of course, the worst part was Kristallnacht, the Kristallnacht, in November 9th and 10th of 1938. By that time, Uncle Richard had suspected that they would have to get out, and he had already, in the previous summer, that is, in the summer of 1938, had gone to the consulate, the American consulate in Stuttgart, and registered for them to, for him and his sister and his sister's son, who happens to be my father, he registered for them to get visas. Well, he then, after Kristallnacht, he worked very, very hard to find some person of the family in America, in New York, that would pledge money to the government so that they could get their visa, because the government was not allowing anybody to come over if they would need any money or any help from the government. So he was able to do that, and then in May of 1939, he immigrated to America first. My dad and his mom couldn't go with him, only because his mom had some problems with her visa that she, with the application for the visa that she had to get fixed, and they got it fixed just a couple months later, and then they made it to America.
More on this story to come, and we're going to include your phone calls and emails, too, as we welcome back to Tallahassee the former rabbi of Temple Israel, Jack Romberg. He has written a new book. We'll talk more about it right here on Perspectives. The return of Perspectives Live in studio and taking calls at 850-414-1234 or email perspectives at WFSU.org. Always available online, of course, at WFSU.org as well. And we archive each show in its entirety, try to have it up within a day or so of when it actually appears on the radio. Hey, speaking of calls, let's go to the phones and say hi and welcome back to Reed, who is giving us a return call after a long hiatus. Mr. Mahoney, how are you, sir?
Brother Tom.
Good to hear from you, Reed.
I think the last time that we spoke, Rabbi Romberg was on with you.
I think you're right.
Yeah, it's been too long for both of you.
True. How's it going, Reed?
Going very well. Enjoying this beautiful weather and out in the country. And I'm excited to hear about the rabbi's new book. I'm wondering, you mentioned, Jack, you mentioned that there's a lot applicable to what's going on today. And I think specifically of deniers, you know, COVID deniers. No, that, you know, this, yeah. And I'm wondering if your book addresses those weirdos that still deny the Holocaust even, you know, happened.
No, I don't talk about that in the book in terms of people who are denying the Holocaust, but I include pieces of history of Germany and, of course, of German Jewish experience in Germany, and of course, a little bit of history of how the Weimar Republic, which was a democratic republic, ends up becoming, you know, a dictatorship, and how it fell apart. And I think that if people read what I wrote about the history, about what happened to the Jewish people, I think that they will see parallels to not exactly what's happening today, but see what could happen if people in our country don't treat each other a little bit better. You know, don't actually respect each other and their positions and their thoughts. And the risk of taking our democratic republic and having it fall apart, you can see some parallels to that. Now, even more of a parallel is, and this is something that blew me away as I was doing all the research, and that is some of the parallels between German Jewish history from the time they were emancipated by Prussia in 1812 and how they were treated for decades, sometimes better, sometimes worse, and the parallel to the history of African Americans here in the United States from the time they were emancipated from slavery during the Civil War and how they were treated, and organizations that existed to go against each group. I mean, the KKK was started here in America. In Germany, there was a political party in the 1890s and the early 1900s that was called the Anti-Semitic Party, that actually did politics on their hatred of Jews. So there are all kinds of interesting parallels and things that are relevant. I don't want to give too much more, but I think that people will see, and I don't talk about the relevance. I talk about the history, and I talk about, and I write about the history. I write about exactly what was going on and how it affected my family. And I have to point out, I am a first-generation American. All of my family, my mom and her family, and my dad and his family, they were all German Jewish refugees getting to America in the late 1930s.
Got it, Reid?
Very lucky.
Yep.
Very lucky they were.
Yeah, and actually you'll see a story about how my dad made it out at 16 years old. And if he wouldn't have been smart enough to do what he did, I wouldn't be sitting here on this program. I wouldn't be alive.
Wow. Well, God bless you and your family, and thank you for all you've done.
Well, thank you for calling in. It's great to hear your voice again.
Yes, it is, Reid.
Take care, Tom.
All righty, sir. You take care of yourself and all the best, okay? 850-414-1234 if you'd like to join the conversation with Jack Romberg, the author of A Doorway to Heroism, about his great uncle, who again became an emigre. He was able to come to the United States when so many German Jews could not flee that situation, Jack. And what happened to him upon his arrival in this country, and how did that happen? He got a sponsor, at least to underwrite his mm-hmm. his immigration for the governmental purposes, but then he comes to America, and then what?
Well, he got to America on, I think it's May 24th is the exact date of 1939. And, of course, the first thing he started to do was to get a job, because he had had in the 1920s into the early 1930s, a nice, successful store business in Cologne, Germany. And he had made nice money that he could support his sister and her son, because he actually became my dad's legal guardian after his sister and her husband had divorced in 1925, 26. So Uncle Richard had taken charge of all that. But anyway, so he first thing he did when he got here is to get a job and start to learn English, okay? And he started to figure out how to set things up because for his sister and his nephew coming to be here. And he also started to do communication for his first cousin, Henny Katz, and her communication with her two sons, one of whom was living in London, England, who had escaped Germany in 1938 and gotten to London, England, and the other son who had gotten down to Johannesburg in South Africa. So what happened is that as soon as the war began on September 1st of 1939, there could be no communication between Henny and her children and her sons. So what happened is Uncle Richard, he wrote, of course, to Henny, that he would take care of the communication. In other words, she could write to him because America was not in the war, so they could receive and send from America, you know, from the United States. And so he did all of the communication of trying to make sure that they were in touch with each other, that they were getting the truth of what was actually happening in the world and what was actually happening in the war. But even more so, even though he had the job, his first job, of being a dishwasher for restaurants and not earning, you know, big money, he was trying to find a way to get his cousin and perhaps even his older brother to get them out of Europe and get them to America. He just kept trying to find ways to do this. His dedication to the family was huge, and this is something that I learned, not that I had known before, and it was not in any of my father's documents or letters, but when I was doing research in Germany, one of the people I was working with actually knew a fellow who had written a book about the Katz family, which was a connected family to the Stern family, and she introduced me to him. And we got together, and he gave me his book, which was written not just in German, but also in English, so it was easy to read. And we just became friends as we hung out in Germany together. And he had 16 more letters, 14 written by Uncle Richard and 2 written by his cousin. And he shared all of Uncle Richard's letters to me. And I learned so much from those that I had not learned before, and that was not part of any of the documents or letters that Dad had had.
This book is not just a labor of love. It sounds like it's a saga of serendipity, too. So many things had to come together in a very timely fashion for this to move forward, Jack.
Yeah, well, I was very fortunate to get into Germany in September of 2019 because everybody that I worked with and that were archivists for like the small town that Uncle Richard was born in, Weilerswist, which is about a 30 to 40 minute drive from Cologne, or those in Cologne and historians in museums. I learned so much from them, and they knew a bunch of things. And one of the things that they told me was that the picture of Uncle Richard, which is on the front of the book, and that's the picture of him standing in the doorway of his store doing his protest right next to a Nazi SA soldier, that picture is in numerous museums all over Germany. He is actually kind of a famous person in Germany because of his willingness to stand up and protest. And that was just not a major thing that happened or a big thing that happened by many Jewish people. There were other Jewish people that protested, but of course there weren't pictures of all of them. But it turns out that, as I said before, he was the only one on April 1st of 1933 in Cologne to stand up against the Nazis, in the first action against the Jewish people. So it just was amazing to work with them. And by the way, all of these historians and archivists that I worked with kept in touch with me and have constantly, they would find things and send them to me and give me more information even after I left Germany. And actually, the historian of the Elde Haus Museum in Germany, which is the museum about the history of the Nazi Party in Cologne, Germany, she actually then asked me to be part of a video that they were putting together for all the people who like to come to their museum, and I did it about 3 weeks ago.
Oh, my gosh. 850-414-1234 as we continue our discussion with former Tallahassee Temple Israel Rabbi Jack Romberg talking about his book, A Doorway to Heroism. Jacob joins us with a follow-up to part of the conversation we just had, Jack, about trying to bring more refugees from Nazi Germany to the United States. And Jacob has a question about that. Thanks for calling, Jacob. Welcome.
Oh, hello. I had a question. I was wondering, Rabbi Romberg, you said that about 85% of the Jews left.
No, not 85% of the Jews left of Germany. 85% of the Jewish people in Germany in the early 20th century were supporters of democracy, the Democratic Republic, and 85%, even in the early 1900s, were voting for example, the Social Democratic Party, or even other parties that had candidates going for the Reichstag, you know, the parliament that was in Germany, even in the early 20th century. That's the 85%. Most of the German Jews did not make it out of Germany. And a good example is Uncle Richard's older brother, who also served in World War I and was on the front line for 4 years for the German army. And he escaped originally to Brussels in Belgium in 1939, but or early 1939. But once the Germans conquered Belgium, they took him, sent him to a camp, and then he was, along with his wife and his daughter, they were eventually sent to Auschwitz and killed in Auschwitz.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. Yeah. Yeah, so I was wondering, see now most of the Jewish people did not get out of Germany. Were most of them trying to get out and like failing to, did some of them choose to stay or what? I'm not totally sure about
that. That's actually a very good question, and the perspective that they took on whether they should stay or leave changed from say 1933-34. The bulk of the Jewish people in 1933, once the Nazis took power, felt that this would be a temporary thing, that because there had been other elections, that at some point, and in fact, the election in November of 1932, the Nazi Party actually had won less than it had in July of 1932. So they kind of had the feeling that Hitler and the Nazi Party wouldn't be forever, and that they could get out of, you know, that they would get out of that situation, and that another party would take, the majority at some point. So a lot of them, including Uncle Richard, didn't feel that they should be leaving Germany, that they should be there and, you know, vote for, you know, the right people and so forth. But of course, by 35, not only had the Nazis made it illegal for any other party to even exist and to do anything to oppose them or whatever, but for example, in September of 1935, in Nuremberg, there were a bunch of laws passed against the Jewish people that put a lot of stuff against the Jewish people. So that's when a larger number of Jews, decided that maybe they should think about leaving. Now, by the way, in 1933 and 34, there were Jews who left Germany. They were the richest of them. They were the ones who could afford to get out, and some of them decided to leave. Now, one of the places that a number of these Jews went to, and in fact, from my mom's family, some did this, a number of those Jews actually went to Palestine, knowing that it would become the state of Israel at some day. So that was something that happened. And in fact, that's where my dad initially wanted to go in the middle of the 1930s. He wanted to immigrate to Palestine to be part of the Jewish nation that would be created there. So it got worse and worse. And by the time Kristallnacht happened in 1938, it was becoming harder and harder and harder for Jews to leave. And more and more and more in 38 and 39 were putting in their applications for visas to get to other places.
Thanks so much. I appreciate that, Jacob. Let's go to line four. Bob awaits there here on Perspectives with Jack Romberg. Hi, Bob. Welcome. Hello, Bob.
Yeah, hi. I had two kind of questions. One was this thing of his uncle joining the American Army when he was 43 years old. You know, I was in the Army when I was 18, and that was rigorous. I mean, that was that was hard work. I can't imagine a 43. And I wondered if his uncle ever talked about that. And the other question that I have, which is not in Rabbi Romberg's book, but, you know, there was, I think, definite institutionalized anti-Semitism in the U.S. State Department that kept an awful lot of European Jews out of the United States, and I mean condemned them to death. I can't remember the name of the ship, but a ship full of Jewish refugees that couldn't land in the United States and couldn't unload in Havana, and finally had to go back to Hamburg, I think, and those people were just murdered because the U.S. State Department had this, like I say, deliberate anti-Semitic approach.
Bob, let's address those here on the other side of a break that's rapidly bearing down on
us.
We appreciate that. And so you hang on, and Jack Romberg will address those questions and more. If you have a question for Jack Romberg, 850-414-1234 as Perspectives returns to an in-studio live caller-friendly kind of program here on WFSU Public Media. We'll be right back. We're back on Perspectives with Jack Romberg as we reinstitute our program on a live in-studio basis with your interaction as well. Boy, great to get phone calls, Jack. It's a wonderful thing. Bob had asked us here about your great uncle, Richard Stern, joining the American Armed Forces at age 43 and then going on to fight for an American cause that in many cases was also a bit anti-Semitic at the time.
Yeah, Uncle Richard volunteered for the American Army at age 43 because once Germany became, you know, the enemy of the United States, he felt that he needed to be part of the, you know, army against the Nazi Party. He felt that he just had to. And he felt so bad about his failure of things that happened to him in Germany, and the failure of his protest, the failure of things that he was trying to get done in Germany, that he felt like if he went into the American Army, it was the best thing. So the unit that he went into happened to be the 48th Engineering Battalion, and he felt very fortunate that they ended up serving in Europe. They actually went to Africa first and then were sent over to Italy. And his battalion was part of the 5th Army that was fighting in Italy against the German army. And what happened was in a certain battle or a certain, you know, set of battles, the casualties of the army was so bad that the engineering battalion had to take up their guns and become infantry. So that is what happened to him. He did it, like I said, because he was just dedicated to going against the Nazis, which I think is a key point. It's just a key point. And he did a lot. When you read the book, you will see not just how he won the Silver Star. And by the way, he should have gotten even a higher medal. It was suggested by his commander that he get a higher medal. But, you know, there's, of course, not only about the Silver Star, but there are other things he did for the Army, other things he did for his battalion, and other things he had to do, including how he was searching for, towards the end of the Army, searching for surviving family members and so forth. That's all part of the book as well. Now, in terms of what Bob was saying about the State Department, yes, there was probably a good chunk, in fact, there was a chunk of anti-Semitism, and the number of Jews not allowed to come from other countries, especially in Eastern Europe, was at a higher percentage than those that were not allowed to come from Germany. Germany, you know, was was better looked at, I guess, in certain ways. And so they were accepted a little bit more. And the problem with Jews coming from Germany was their, as I had said before, their lack of thinking that it was something they should do early on, as opposed to waiting until it got way too hard for them to even get out of the country. So those are the, you know, I would say the answers.
The other thing is that in World War I, I recall, and not that I was there, of course, but I read history like you, Jack, there was such an anti-German sentiment in the United States that anyone who would have immigrated or even had been in the U.S. for a long time who was German would never have been allowed to enlist in the armed forces in World War I. There was a very, very anti-German sentiment there, as I recall, sauerkraut being renamed Liberty Cabbage, all that kind of thing. But in World War II, there seemed to be a lot more flexibility on the part of America's armed forces, that if you were an immigrant, you would be allowed to serve, even if you came from the enemy nation.
Yes. And in fact, one of the documents I have is a letter from an American officer who met Uncle Richard when he volunteered and was so impressed with what Uncle Richard wanted to do and how he was really dedicated to being in the American Army that he wrote this beautiful letter back to him and thanked him for who he was. And this was just when he had volunteered and just when he was getting into the Army originally. So I think the approach was a bit different, especially by the military. I think the military, you know, felt that there were people that they should have to, you know, make the Army more complete. And somebody like Uncle Richard, especially them being, you know, in Europe, somebody who could speak German, it was very, very important that there were people in the American Army that could speak German and understand what was going on and so forth. And actually, one of Uncle Richard's good friends who was in the same engineering battalion was a bit younger than him, but also was a Jew from Germany. You know, so I think they were about 18 or 20 years apart in age. But the point is both of them being from Germany, Jews from Germany, they became, you know, friends in that battalion.
Jack, this is kind of speculative in nature, and you can't get totally inside someone's mind to prognosticate how they may react or think about a certain thing. But from all the research that you did and even some of the first-person documentation that was produced by your great uncle Richard there, what lessons do you think he would have for us today, given our contemporary set of circumstances? We see a resurgence of anti-Semitism in some quarters, and the political divisiveness and everything else that we're dealing with. How do you think he'd react to all that?
Well, I think that he would want, number one, he would want people to be able to stand up for their civil rights. That's what he did in 1933. And another aspect is he wrote a letter that he wrote to Dad when both of them were in the Army, by the way, and it was towards the end of the war. One of the things he wrote to Dad was, don't forget the important reason why we had to be in the Army and what we're opposing, what we're fighting against. In other words, you have to stand up for what is right and what is justice. You have to not just stand back from opposing those people, those groups that are doing bigotry and suppression of certain people, because that's what they experienced. And by the way, while Uncle Richard didn't talk about that to me as a little kid, my dad actually talked about it to me one time when I was about six, seven years old, and I had used the wrong word in a song that somebody heard me singing about African Americans. I used the wrong word, and Dad pulled me aside one morning. Instead of us playing like we normally did on a Sunday morning when I would go into his bedroom, he sat me down, and I could see he looked very concerned. And he said to me, I have to tell you about what happened to us as Jews in Germany. And he started to tell me about how you have to respect other people. You cannot use words that you know, that criticize them or make them feel bad or whatever. You have to treat them, you know, properly and in honor and so forth. And so, you know, that all, of course, came from Uncle Richard. Now, I think the biggest thing that I learned in studying about Uncle Richard is you've got to be there for your family, and you got to get your family to stop arguing with each other, and you've got to get them to come together, especially when times get hard. You've got to be together and act together to do what's right, to do what's moral.
Let's go back to the phones. Mark has been hanging on very patiently, and we appreciate that more than you know, Mark. Thanks, and welcome to Perspectives. Hello, Mark. We hope Mark's still there. Okay, line is active. He may have stepped away for a moment. We'll see if we can get him on. That, if I may pull another phrase out of the air here, that blessed be the peacemakers, when it comes to families here, is that even doable, Jack? We are bearing down on some great American holiday times when families who heretofore may have been all together and at least singing out of, you know, one hymnal, perhaps, may have more opportunity now for contention than ever. I'm thinking, you know, Thanksgiving and the other year-end holidays there. Any advice for how we can handle some of these situations if people would rather use that as an opportunity for disagreement rather than conviviality?
There's not a problem with disagreement. The problem is, do you respect somebody who disagrees with you? And can you have a discussion with them where you talk about why you believe what you believe and what is it, you know, what is it that you feel is correct? Now, while you have to respect people with, you know, respect somebody with a different perspective or a different, you know, feeling on certain things, there are, of course, some things that are just simply wrong. If somebody is a racist, that's wrong. If somebody is anti-Semitic, that is wrong. If somebody does not care what happens to other people, doesn't care that they get sick, doesn't care that they die, doesn't care that they are just poor and needy and doesn't care about doing anything to help them. Now, helping them doesn't necessarily mean a specific position, say, of a particular Democratic Party, but the way political things went years ago was that the political parties would get together and say, okay, here's the problem, let's figure out the best way. And yes, conservatives had a certain perspective and progressive had another perspective, but at least there was discussions and respect of the other one's perspective. And that's the way we have to be. We have to have respect for another person's position or another person's perspective, except if it is against people. If it's against, you know, a specific ethnic group or religious group or whatever, you have to go beyond that. That is just not moral. It's not correct.
And division carried to its irrational conclusion. Mm-hmm. It's essentially the Holocaust.
Yes, absolutely. The Holocaust is, in fact, there's a great book by Michael Guerin, who is a professor. He's a professor at West Point, and he's a history professor, and he wrote a wonderful book about German Jewish soldiers in World War I and what happened to them in the 1930s and going into the Holocaust. And he became my friend, actually, when he saw the article that CNN did about Uncle Richard and me writing the book way back in January of 2020. So in any case, what he writes about in his book that is just, you know, was so educational is that in 1933, when the Nazis took power and for the first few years, other veterans of the German army, most of them wanted to stand by their co-veterans who were Jewish because they appreciated what they had done. And I have other stories, actually, from the other part of my family, not the Stern part, but the Romberg part of the family, that I have stories about things that happened with them, that they were actually helped by a Nazi party member, but who liked them because the fellow had served in the German army in World War I and actually saved this person from being taken over by during the Kristallnacht. So there are examples of this. But here's the thing. Once it got to 1938, once it got past Kristallnacht, then even the veterans from World War I, they had turned, because the Nazi Party had took so much power and was doing so much in the way they were controlling the country that nobody could disagree with them and actually still at least not be in prison, let alone not be killed.
Well, we know what the death total was out of that, or at least we have a pretty good guesstimate there, and the fact that your great uncle Richard was able to survive and go on and to support the rest of the family and also fight for the cause of good in World War II. Just what a fantastic story. But it was like giving birth, from what I understand, Jack. It's never easy to write a book, particularly one so steeped in history and first-person documentation as this one here. Any more on the horizon, or is this going to be it for a while?
That's a funny question. I've been thinking about, do I want to write another book, but is it going to be another book on the same kind of subject? I actually have an idea for something completely different. But I was just about a week ago, I actually did a podcast with somebody, and that podcast is going to be broadcasted on November 26th. And this is somebody who does a whole series of podcasts for the Jewish community across the country, and it's very, very well followed. And it turns out it's not just Jewish people that listen to it, but, you know, it's a nice big group of people. And when we were done, you know, recording what was going to be broadcast, he then said to me, you know, you need to write another book too.
Thanks a bunch.
I don't know. I got to see, you know, right now there's so much I've got to get done. Tonight is just the first in-person speaking. There is a lot more that's going to come about. I have colleagues that want me to come and speak in their congregations. My very next in-person speaking, though, is going to be in Washington, D.C. on October 31st in the afternoon, and that's in the National Museum of American Jewish Military History. They have bought a chunk of the books. They want me to come in and do a talk about Uncle Richard and his story, a little bit more focused on the military part. But, you know, I have friends who want to get me to speak in different Holocaust museums and so forth. So, I mean, it's you know, that's what I got to focus on right now. I can't think of too many things at one time. When you're getting older, you don't think as much, or you forget more things.
And you thought life after Temple Israel was just going to be a piece of cake, huh?
I would have been happy with a piece of cake, which actually I don't eat anymore.
That's right. We could get into all of that, but time is flying. A Doorway to Heroism by Jack Romberg, former rabbi of Temple Israel in Tallahassee. He will be back at his old stomping grounds at 7 o'clock tonight. There is registration, though, that is required. Of course, it will be a masked event and social distancing and all that in keeping with our contemporary requirements here. But there is a registration for that. I think that is on Temple Israel's page, if I am not mistaken. You can also, if you would like, call the folks over at Midtown Reader, because they are helping to coordinate a lot of this event this evening also. And Jack will be speaking about the book as well as doing a signing on it.
Well, it's Midtown Reader that is actually, or so I would say, call Midtown Reader to register. Sally Bradshaw, who I've known for, you know, a nice chunk of time, I am grateful to Sally for wanting to do this. I am just so grateful to her, and the folks at the Midtown Reader have been wonderful, so please call them.
When it comes to hometown authors, and Jack, you will, even though you don't have a domicile in Tallahassee anymore, you will always be a hometown hero as far as we're concerned, and it's just so great to be speaking with you again. And also, this is an open invitation for any time you're in the area. Just give a call, and we would love to have you come back and talk about your latest exploits as you move into what I'm sure is the next stage of adventure for you. And good to see you, sir.
Good to see you.
Perspectives produced by WFSU-FM in Tallahassee. Technical assistance by Taylor Cox, Lydell Rawls, Paul Dam, the crew on the video side of the house, and Kim Kelling, our executive producer. I'm Tom Flanagan. Pandemic's been tough on everyone, including caregivers. We'll talk about that next week, live and in studio with your calls right here on Perspectives from WFSU Public Media. Take care.